Are you afraid? You should be.
I thought he was the man to lead us through the long night.
A face will be added to the whole.
You would spill blood in this holy place.
The gods were mine.
Show them what Lannisters are.
And make no mistake, the dead are coming.
Dragons do not do well in captivity.
How do you know this?
That's what I do. I drink, and I know things.
They have no idea what's going to happen.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to the Winter is Coming Game of Thrones podcast. This is Take the Black, and I am your host, Razor, and I'm joined by three of my co-hosts, Isis, Corey, and Annie. How are you guys doing tonight, and are you excited about the first episode of Game of Thrones Season 6? Go, Isis.
I am super pumped. I enjoyed it. I can't wait until we talk about it. I particularly really enjoyed our live tweet. It was a whole lot of fun. We got to interact with a lot of people who are Game of Thrones fans who brought a lot to the discussion. So, hey, you guys who are live tweeting, we're going to try to do this every week, and I had a great time.
Yeah, that was fun. And, again, I've said it before. I'll say it again. Follow Isis on Twitter. Give Annie and Corey a follow as well. They're going to be live tweeting when they can, and they're really fun to follow. Annie had a particularly funny meme, the Miracle Max meme at the end of the episode that made me spill some milk out of my nose as I was laughing hard. And so we also have Corey and Annie. I'm glad you guys got to join us, and I'm glad that we're going to do this again this week. Let's get right into things. Jon Snow's body, the show starts, and first of all, Annie, you made a very astute observation. It was like 8.5 minutes before the episode even started. Like, when has Game of Thrones ever done, like, 8.5 minutes of previously seen? Have they ever done that on a episode one?
Yeah, actually, they kind of do on the first episode, but this one felt particularly egregious because it was just like, it really did feel like, you know, previously on Game of Thrones, seasons 1 through 5.
Yeah, did it feel, maybe it was because we're all sitting there waiting for Jon Snow. Maybe that's what it was. We're all sitting there waiting for Isis's little cinnamon bun. Like, we're waiting for the flowy hair, and we're waiting for Kit Harington to pop up on screen and open his eyes and go, psych, I'm here. But that didn't happen, and the camera panned down, and instantly my heart got ripped out of my chest because Ghost is howling. And if you're a book reader, you know that Ghost is mute. He's the only mute direwolf of the whole bunch. So there's as a book reader, you're like, whatever. But still, it kind of rips your heart out a little bit because as the other children of the Starks, when they died, their direwolves howled. And as you're reading the books, when that moment happens and the direwolves howl, it's always a really sad moment. So that's what kind of brought those emotions up for me. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't think I can take this. But Isis, I'm going to go back to you really quick because you and I were tweeting back and forth on this point. When they showed Ed Toilette inside the room and he's standing there and he puts his hands on John's body and he closes his eyes, how much did that just rip your heart out of your chest?
Oh, man, it really did because, you know, I thought at the same time, you know, we've always felt like John has been on his own, whether or not, you know, he was with mm-hmm. his brothers and sisters or half brothers and sisters, whatever. He's always really kind of been on his own. And to hear Ghost crying for him was like, OK, he's not alone. And then to see his boys, you know, like, who do you trust? Everybody in this room. That's basically it. Us. We trust each other. This is it. And it was so nice to see that at least he wasn't alone in that moment. It really did tear me up.
For him to say he was my friend, I was like, oh my God, I don't think I can watch the show anymore. I'm done. He was my friend.
And that's the thing is I could watch like, you know, videos of faces of death, but I see like a grown man like have some kind of emotion or something like that.
God damn, faces of death?
Shit. Oh, I know I'm reaching way back, but I'm a little bit older than most people. But anyway, you guys can, for you youngins, you could Google it and you'll be like, oh my goodness. But anyway, I'm serious. Like if I see like a grown man crying, that brings me to tears. But it was very emotional and it was very, I want to say just really strong, because like at the whole time I felt like the only real friend that John had was his little bud, who's not even there anymore. And I just felt like it was really kind of one of those things that these guys would really they would die for him, and they were willing to.
Annie, I'm going to come back to you in a second for a book reader's point of view. But, Corey, let me ask you really quick. How did you feel about Alistair Thorne turning the tide so quickly? Like he made people like, yeah, I'm a traitor. Yeah, I killed Jon Snow. And I did it for a really shitty reason. He brought the wildlings over, and he thought it was a really good reason, and that made us kill him. Yeah, we're murderers. And all of a sudden, the rest of the Night's Watch were like, oh, yeah, okay, that's cool, no problem. How did you feel about that? That was kind of like a shitty moment to me. What did you feel about that?
I've always really liked that character. I mean, obviously he's a prick, but like I think he's a very well-formed and well-acted character.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. At least we know what he is.
Yeah, well, it's a very good point. I think maybe he's almost a breath of fresh air because of how honest he is. Mm-hmm. And that's what made that speech so – I think why he was able to get people rallied around him like that was because he was very upfront about it. So we killed him because of these reasons. And if you disagree – I mean, he didn't say this, but like if you disagree, then you know we can do something about it. But as it is right now, this is why we did it. And everybody – I think pretty much everyone except for John and a couple others, the guys in that room basically – we're not really on board with the wildling situation.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, them saying, that's why we did it, and you know why we did it, and, you know, him just kind of putting it on them and saying, you guys didn't have the balls to do it, but it had to be done. I don't know. I thought that it was a good scene. I thought that he did a great job.
How'd you feel about the smug little shit Ollie standing up there beside him? Like, that really pissed me off. That got me. Like, I didn't mind Thorne, because you're right. Thorne's a really good character. He's fleshed out, and we know who he is. We know what kind of guy he is. He's always been a dick to John. We always knew he was going to turn on John. As a book reader, I always knew that. So I was expecting that. But there's Ollie, and he's standing there, and he's looking at everybody. And then he turns, and he stands up by the front, and he's staring at all the rest of the Black Brothers, and he's looking at him like, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And I was just hoping somebody would just shoot an arrow right in his eyeball. I was just like, oh, my God, I hate this little guy, and I just want somebody to kill him so hard right now.
I think that I've never seen a show do as good of a job with young actors as Game of Thrones has done. And the kid that plays Ollie has done a great job of going from being everybody's favorite little buddy to to the one that – that's the thing is that there isn't there isn't a fuck – Alistair Thorne subreddit, it's fuck Ollie.
Nope. And is there true. There's a fuck
and really,
Ollie
is a kid, and he doesn't know how to process his feelings, and he can't. We're asking Ollie to think, logically. And can't you be more forward thinking, you 11-year-old? No, and I can't. 11. So like, he hates the wildlings, and I totally get why. And he's very mad that his best friend John did that, and then Alistair Thorne is like, listen, I told you he's going to do this, and I think Ollie. Personally, I would love to see this is just, again, this is how good the show is overall, that it's got me cheering for yet another child to die. But I would love to see Ghost just pounce on Ollie's face and eat it. And when that door opens, he just beelines it straight for Ollie. That would be the best. But
that would be – I think you would – there would be a thunderous applause that you would actually hear out in the streets. People would be cheering. There would be parties.
Because it will be one of the few times this show has given us something to cheer for.
Exactly. Exactly. I want Annie, I want to talk to you real quick. Now, you, as a book reader, you've read the end of A Dance with Dragons. Mm-hmm. You know what happens to John. Well, we know that he gets stabbed. We didn't know what was going to happen to John. We didn't know in the books. We don't know in the books what happens to him. Now, this is the show. This is how the show interprets things. This is how Benioff and Weiss interprets things. How did you feel about this finality to John's fate so far,
well,
I guess?
I mean, I'm not going to sing, but literally in my head, the song John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave?
Yes.
That was literally playing in my head. John Snow's body lies a-moldering in the snow. I just – and his soul goes marching on, but the – one of the things that really struck me about the scene, and this is because I'm a book reader, in the books, the Wildlings are still in Castle Black.
Mm-hmm.
And that was mm-hmm. a thing that really startled me in this episode, is that Ed has to have left Castle Black to go bring the Wildlings back. The Wildlings were allowed to pass through, and they've left. And
yeah,
that actually really startled me. I was not expecting that. It also kind of made it, you know, when the Wildlings are there and they're being housed in Castle Black, and the Night's Watch are being forced to share their rations with them and share mm-hmm. the bathrooms and share what water they have, it's a lot more intense, and you kind of understand in a way, you know,
why they were saying.
I mean, they're racist against Wildlings. Like, they are. They've been racist against Wildlings the entire time. They've been brought up to be racist against Wildlings. To them, Wildlings were the others, because they didn't really know about White Walkers. So mm-hmm. there's a level where, to them, the Wildlings are the real bad guys.
Right.
Having the Wildlings have passed through and not actually being Castle Black, I thought actually I understand why they did it. It's so that they could draw this bit out, so that, you know, the fight doesn't happen until episode 2. But at the same time, like, I was like, you know, that kind of takes away a little bit of the punch. But, you know, at the same time, though, Owen Teal did an amazing job with Alice Thorne. I mean, he just did.
Yeah,
and that scene was one of the best scenes of the night, along with the mutton one.
Yeah, the mutton one.
Seriously,
was going to say...
Don't ask for mutton. Ask for turkey. I mean, seriously, pack right if you're going to go traveling in the snow. Okay, anyway.
I was going to say, I think it was pretty obvious why they had the Wildlings be away from Castle Black, so they could extend the drama at least one more episode. It's one of those things that actually is starting to annoy me about the show, is how they almost intentionally draw things out further than necessary just to keep, like, I don't think it was necessary to save that fight for the next episode, or maybe even the third episode. Let's be honest, there's no guarantee it's going to happen next episode either.
That's
they
true.
Could stay in that room and play Uno for all we know. And also, I don't think that they're necessarily racist against Wildlings.
No, in the books they are more than in the books. It's much more obvious, is what I was. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear on that.
I was going to say it was jingoism, probably, but that's.
Well, you know, that was a really good way to open up the season, and I'm glad they did it that way, and I'm glad the battle lines are drawn.
Hang on, we didn't actually talk about the person that drove that scene, though. We didn't talk about Sir Davos. Like,
no, we are going to talk about Sir Davos.
Man.
We are going to go back to Sir Davos. But you know, since you go ahead and mention him, we can stay here and talk about him. Sir Davos actually was really, Leon Cunningham was very brilliant in those scenes, and he was brilliant from the word go. When he's sitting on the bed, he's still, like, you can tell that he's still in mourning for Shireen and for Stannis, because he's sitting on the side of the bed. And he's hanging his head, and he's all sorrowful, and he's sad. And then he hears Ghost howling, so he comes down the stairs, and he sees John. And then he rallies the friends of John, and they go up in the room, and he's just brilliant the way he's real witty with Alistair Thorne, like, you know, bring mutton. And then he tells him, I've been dealing with these men my entire life. You know, we're not going to get out of here. But there was a, you know, although he was really great in those scenes, The gentleman who plays Ed, he equally drove those scenes quite well while he was there, and he had that one line that to me could have battled for line of the night, although there were some great lines in the episode. But he said, if you plan on seeing daylight, you're in the wrong room.
Ben
Crompton.
Yeah, Crompton.
Yeah,
if you plan on seeing the day, you're in the wrong room. And I was like, oh my God, that is a great line, because that right there, the battle lines were drawn. And that told me that there was no surrender. They did not plan on leaving Castle Black peacefully.
And
I was happy.
And I agree with you. I think for me, Ed, his portrayal, he's really – hopefully he will stay alive. I don't know if he'll make it throughout season 6. But I really felt like he was like ride or die. I'm all about John. I'm sticking with him. The only side note I had, and I didn't tweet this, but I was like, okay, so Sir Alistair, oh no, not Alistair, the other guy, the
Davos.
He was sitting in the room, like chilling, pontificating and stuff like that. And he hears the wails of Ghost. And I'm like, okay, if he can hear the wails of Ghost, How did he not hear the fucking angry mob that just stabbed Jon Snow?
Well, they were quiet. They were relatively quiet when they murdered Jon. They
but
were like
the amount of
they were
people
out there.
That were out there. You gonna hear something? You know,
let's not talk about continuity.
I know, I know. But I was that was the only thing that like took me out of the moment was like, how did you not hear the horde, the angry mob out there stabbing, you know, Flip and Jon Snow? But anyway, it's nor here nor there. I really, really enjoyed that whole moment because it made me really feel like that Jon, he was being a leader. And they really did have their back. And even when Sir Alistair was saying, like, hey, yeah, I killed, you know, our guy and, you know, he was our leader and stuff like that. But I did it for this, this and that, whether you agree with him or not. But there were still guys in that room that didn't agree with him, you know. But Alistair was like basically like, all right, well, you can not agree with me and die or you can agree with me and be here. And it's like, what do you do? So, you know, and those guys really have no life other than being at the wall. So, I mean, what are you going to do?
Let me ask you a question, Corey, since you brought up Davos. Should he trust Melisandre at this point? He let her in the room, and he even told them, well, we still have the Red Witch or the Red Woman. Should he trust Melisandre now that you've seen that she's basically
The Shining?
She's the ghost in room 237.
Hey, look, when 400-year-olds you be, not look so good, you will.
What the hell, Yoda? What the hell?
Sorry, though, really, that is actually the line that I thought of when she took off the when she took off.
Oh, I totally had
that Yoda moment in my brain as like all of Twitter went ew, and I'm like, seriously, guys, yeah, no, it's totally. Just an old woman. Let's not be ageist. Let's not be sexist. When you're 400 years old, you're not gonna look so good either.
And I really don't want to talk about the Melisandre reveal just yet. We're gonna come back to that, but I just want to ask you, Corey, since you brought it up, should he trust her at this point? I mean, she killed Shireen, she burned her, and she betrayed Stannis because she read the fires wrong. She read the whatever. She led him down a wrong path. She saw the sight wrong. She interpreted her dreams wrong. And because of that, Stannis is dead, Selyse is dead, and Shireen was burned. All of that because Melisandre did the wrong thing or interpreted her dreams and the fires wrong. So should he trust Melisandre at this point?
I mean, I think he has no choice or anything else. You look at the situation they're in. I mean, he knows that she can be a X factor if she gets to the room, if she comes back. I don't know. I mean, I can't remember exactly, but I feel like that Davos and the Red Woman had a moment last season after the girl was burned where they, like, made eye contact, and you could tell that, like, like she legitimately felt like not only was it her fault, that she, it was her fault, everything. And she was just
that
wrong.
Look on her face, the look at the feet on her face when she comes riding through Castle.
Because, you know, as we've established in this show already, is her god might be like the actual god. Like, they can raise people from the dead without being White Walkers, and you know, they have these, they can give birth to smoke babies out of their muffs. So, you know, it's they have these powers that are legitimate. So, you know, it's part of the first time in her X number of years where she's been like, what am I doing wrong? Has God abandoned me? I don't know, you know, why I'm in this situation that I'm in. And that's kind of because doesn't she like never really sleep? Isn't that a thing with her?
That's a thing. So the fact that we saw her going to bed was
go to bed, yeah.
That way.
Yeah, that's more of a thing they've described in the books than they have in the show. How, and she said more times than not in the books that she has no need for sleep and she stays up and nobody's really ever seen her sleep or really eat for that matter. She doesn't really take nourishment in that much.
Well, old people
so,
don't.
So if they do, it's like at 5 o'clock in the afternoon anyway. So yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot going on, and Davos has to, I guess, take what he can at this point for help. But let's move past the wall for now. We'll come back. Let's talk about King's Landing, and I'm going to ask you something, Isis. As a mother, does Cersei get any kind of break for her, does she, you feel sorry for her at all now that she's lost Marcella? Like, you saw her joyfully walking, gleefully walking down the steps to go greet her daughter and her brother as they're coming back from Dorne, and all of a sudden she sees that it's actually her daughter's under the golden shroud, and the prophecy's coming true, and the smile goes from happiness to sad and despair. So does she deserve a break at this point? She did the Walk of Atonement, and that was a horrible moment, and she spent time in prison, and now her daughter's dead along with her son, Joffrey. So is it time to give Cersei a break?
The answer would be no.
Okay, all right.
No, this is the deal, is that as a mom, you know, I genuinely felt bad for her as far as the loss of her daughter and the fact that she could see, you know, the goodness in her daughter and, you know, contra who she is and how her daughter, you know, how did I end up having this great daughter, you know, and look who I am, you know.
That was a great line from her, how yeah. Marcella was pure and good, and she thought she couldn't be a monster anymore if she had Marcella.
So, you know, to see that Cersei is, you know, realizes that she's genuinely not a good person, and her daughter was, and then she was still taken away. I really, really did feel for her for that portion, because, you know, everybody talks about, oh, love, I love my husband unconditionally. No, the only unconditional love is the one of your child, okay? There's always conditions with a husband, or I should say with a spouse. There's always conditions. But your children, it's unconditional. So I really did feel for her in that fact, but she is no way, no shape or form on her way for redeeming herself. And, you know, seeing her interact with her brother / baby daddy, I guess that's what we're going to call it, was really icky too. So it kind of went like, you know, I understood where her pain was coming from, and then it got really icky. But it's, you know, it is what it is. But it was just one of those moments that, like, look, I can understand. I would feel the exact same way if my child or two of my children have died. And not only that, but she has this prophecy hanging over her head. And I really did like the fact that her brother / baby daddy was really trying to, you know, kind of say, oh, fuck that. That's not what it is. You don't even believe.
I was going to bring that up. Annie, I was going to ask.
Go ahead.
Did House Lannister change their words now to fuck everything?
Well, you know, I in a way, I feel like that is Jaime trying to pull her out of it. Like, I know for most of us, we expected when Marcella came back in a coffin under a golden shroud that Cersei would lose it. Like, I was expecting screams. I was expecting, like, her hair being – what little hair she had to be torn out of her head. I was expecting her to go around setting fire to things. And instead, it's this absolutely dead, like, all the prophecies are true. My life is fucked. My life is over. Nothing matters. And that intense depression is not something that Cersei has ever really exhibited. So I felt like that scene with Jaime is basically him almost panicking. Dude, don't come back to me! You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But do you think it was because it was fresh from her doing her walk of shame, from her being in jail, that all of that kind of played
into
her being so reflective of, like, oh my gosh, you know, my daughter. And she even says that she really didn't, I don't think she really expected her daughter to come back alive. She had
no
hope.
No, she didn't. She said early on that she didn't think she would ever see Marcella again, though it was less that Marcella would die and more that Marcella would be married off, and travel is so long and so hard, and she'd have to stay home and have babies, and just it would never happen. They would never get to see each other again. It wasn't actually that her daughter would die.
Yeah. So it was just a sad, really, you know, sad moment as far as her children.
But you still
concerned.
Don't think she deserves a break, though. You still think that Cersei is unforgivable.
Cersei, you know, it's one of those things, and we'll talk about it, I think, in our next segment, is that we're, you know, there are some people that can still be redeemed. Maybe even Reek would fall into that category of still being redeemed. But I think Cersei is so far down the rabbit hole at this point that I don't think that her loss of a child will redeem all the evils that she has done. I feel sorry for her children, but it's not. It's not going to, you know, like, aw, poor Sophie.
That's a nice, that's a nice segue.
Do have one question before we segue, though. Do you feel sorry for Marjorie?
No, because I honestly feel like at this point, everything's gonna be okay with Marjorie, and that's not just because I know what I know of the season from writing at Wick. I just feel like everything's gonna be okay for at least Marjorie. I don't know about Loras, but she's too smart. She's too cunning, and she's gonna find her way out of there no matter what she has to do. But once she gets out, she's going to bring hell down on the High Sparrow. Somehow.
But you see, that's the thing, is that I felt like her scene with the High Sparrow, she became reflective.
That look on her face, though, to me was like, ooh, he just gave me a way out. That's what it kind of looked like to
me. Well, and I understand that. But at the same time, she's also probably thinking about her part in her, I guess, you know, being, I don't want to say evil, she's not evil, but, you know, the things that she's done wrong, you know, trying to get ahead and everything. So I think she'll become also a little bit more reflective, but I absolutely think that she's all about getting out of there. And I mean, but she wants to get her brother out of there too, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But
the thing about Loras and Marjorie is they are just like Jaime and Cersei without the sex. They're just as close. They love each other. They're dedicated to each other. There's nothing that Marjorie wouldn't do for her brother. And so I don't think that she would leave willingly without her brother. So I think that's going to come into play later on in the season. We'll probably see that happen somehow, some way. She'll probably come into contact with Loras, hopefully. We'll see that resolved before the season comes to a close. And we're only on episode one. Let's go to the north really quick and let's talk about Theon. Well, I don't want to get over this. I don't want to do this really quick. I want to stay here for a little bit. But Corey, last time we talked about the north in season five, you had a lot of great things to say about the jump from the wall. And honestly, this is the first time we've seen Theon and Sansa since season five and the jump. We didn't know if they broke their legs, if they sprained an ankle, if they stubbed a toe. We didn't really know what happened to them from the jump. And it seemed like they came out unscathed. So how did you feel about jump, them running through the woods? And, I mean, how did you feel about that whole, like, they basically came out okay, everything's great, and now everything's going to be okay for – everything's coming up aces for Sansa and Theon.
So I'll be honest. At first I was upset that they didn't even try to address how they jumped from a 40-foot wall and just ran away. But then I was like, you know what? I'm glad you didn't, because that's just more time dealing with this dumb shit, and I'm glad we can move on. And, you know, then we get them running through the woods, and it's, of course, it's cold, and apparently frostbite doesn't exist in Middle Earth, wherever we're at right now. Westeros.
We are such freaking nerds, I swear.
Sorry, I got my magical kingdom mixed up. So anyway, they're at Epcot, and
they run through gloves and hats.
Exactly, they run through a frozen river, and nobody even sneezes or gets the sniffles. And then, you know, basically, I started to get a little excited in the storyline, guys. I'm serious, because I thought for a brief moment they were going to kill Sansa, and I was like, thank God.
The most
useless character in the show, and I am including the fat kid that made bread. The most useless character in the show.
He was very useful. He made pies.
He did. Hot pies.
He made direwolf bread.
He did. No, I mean, seriously, she up until that point, every decision she made was dumb. Every sentence she said was dumb. She had no clue what the hell to do. And then, of course, finally, Brienne of Tarth, she's now one of 142 of her oaths. She kept Sansa alive, and Sansa, I half expected her to be like, no, I don't want your help, big woman, and like run away. Like something else stupid. But instead, she gets to, she now they're all kicking it. We got the the mystery team up in the woods. So I mean, I'm excited. I'm excited that we got to see Brienne actually fight someone again. And anytime Pod is on screen is a good day.
Pod was holding his own. Pod did great.
The most interesting aspect of that, I think, though, was all the very subtle cues from Alfie Allen, who plays Theon, him remembering, like, oh shit, I have like 15 years of sword fighting experience. Oh shit, sure. I am actually a decent fighter and I'm a man, damn it. And picking up the sword and like protecting Sansa and remembering like what it meant to be somewhat human. Like, I don't think he'll ever be normal again. I doubt he lives much longer, to be honest with you. But
I like that because I feel like he was coming out of his shell in this scene. Like, he came out of the Reek. He dropped the Reek act altogether in this scene. Like, he's no longer Reek. He's all Theon. And he, like you said, he picked up a sword. He saved Pod from the Bolton Man. He rescued Sansa this time. Like, of course, they made it to the Cold River, and nobody came out with sniffles. But they were freezing and wet, and he hugged Sansa. That was a very tender moment. They were hugging and for warmth, and it was very tender, and it was very nice. And then when Brienne presents her sword to Sansa, she looks over to Theon, and he nods at her. And I was like, oh, my God, that's a big moment for them
and
two.
And Podrick having to tell her what to say, I thought,
yeah,
was
that
great.
Was cool. Like, I like that moment.
And
that
I will say this, too. I was very – I don't know. That was some of the best choreography we've seen from the show, not counting the big fight with all the zombies, like, because that was different. That was some of the best, like, just one-on-one choreography we've seen in a long time, because all the shit in Dorne has been awful. So we haven't seen, like, good one-on-one or two-on-two combat, I mean, in a while, guys. And that was good.
I actually thought that the comparison of the fight with Brienne and Pod versus the Dornish women and the what went down in Dorne was very interesting, because with Brienne, Gwen Christie, and I can't think of the name of the kid who plays Pod. Crap.
Michael.
Daniel Portman.
Thank you, Daniel Portman. The two of them made killing another human being look hard. Killing another human being is hard. They fight back. You know, it's really difficult. It's not pretty. It's not, and that's one of the things I've always loved about the Brienne scenes, when she fought the Hound. That was an ugly fight. She fights ugly, you know, and she brought that back, that ugliness to the fight, which it made it feel really real to me.
She didn't come in with her Valyrian sword and chop everybody's head off. She was knocked off her horse, kicked in the face, and still was able to somehow rally and fight her way through it. And that was brutal, and I love that aspect of it.
Yeah, and
you guys remember – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, as you guys remember from last year, you know, Brienne's one of my favorite characters. I love her. She's my spirit animal. To see her riding in – and someone told me – I guess they were 2 minutes ahead of me, and they said, hey, you're going to like the next couple of minutes. And when I saw Brienne riding in that horse, and I was like, oh, my God, I love this. I'm already here. I'm there for this. I'm all over it. I love the fact that she came in there with all the strength. I mean, it almost makes up for not seeing her very much from last year. And so I was like, oh, God, it is dick wrecking time. I was here for it. I was like, as a matter of fact, that's what I tweeted. I was like, it's dick wrecking time. She is here. She's finally going to go ahead and make
the music
really
was exciting
happen.
For that. They really did a great job with the music.
Absolutely.
For that scene.
And Pod was, like everybody said, he was exceptional. I mean, you know, how do you not love Pod? But it feels like that whole season that they were stuck in that room, like, he actually learned stuff. You know what I mean? Like, he learned how to wreck dicks and probably, wreck some punani too at the same time, because you know he was.
I just want to know where that axe was. I wish he had the axe with him this time, though. He did have that sword, and I was like, oh man, Tyrion's axe.
Yeah, I know. I was fine with everything, and it made me feel like, okay, this, you know, he was now worthy to be with Brienne and run in Tyrion's crew. So I was really happy about that. I would have maybe been a smidge happier if it wasn't Theon who killed that guy, that it would actually have been Sansa. I would have been like, all right, girl, yay.
You're asking a lot.
So what you're saying, hold on. What I think you're saying is Theon stole somebody else's agency.
I felt like when she said she wasn't going to get into that river because it was too damn cold, I was like, bitch, your agency is about to get taken from you again. You better get in that water now. And so the entire time I was like, I don't see why you're complaining. I mean, you better get on Theon's back and you better kind of swim or something. I love
that whole scene. I kept thinking of people talking about triggers and agency stealing, and I kept thinking, man, people are going to think this is so awesome. And then when he stabbed the guy in the back for Pod, I was like, oh God, he stole somebody's agency.
He stole his agency. But it was really, it just really kind of shows to me that she is just kind of in the situation. I don't really feel like she's ever been a real player in the game at all. But she'll probably fucking be the last one standing. So
before we leave the North, I want to ask you guys, Corey, I'll start with you. I want to ask you guys about what you thought about Ramsay's scene with Miranda's body. That was great because, first of all, it starts off really tender, and he's talking about how when he first met her, and like he's almost crying. He's almost like teary-eyed at this point, right? And you start to think, wow, does Ramsay actually have a heart? And then he ends the scene with, barrier or burner, it's all the same, we need the meat.
And I'm just like, oh, feed her to the dogs.
Oh, my God, yes. There's the Ramsay we all know and loathe. I'm so glad he's back.
See, but that goes in line to who he is. I mean, even in his most tender moment. You know, and so when they say that, Sansa's agency was stolen from her and everything. No, Ramsay was doing what Ramsay does. So it was not completely out of character for that or what he did last night. So that's my opinion.
to feed Miranda's body to the dogs. That's what he does with somebody he actually cares about. What do you think he would have done to Sansa if he caught her? That's what I'm saying. That would have been horrible. That would have been a nightmare. But before we approach and broach the subject of Dorne, I forgot to put this in one of our topics. We're going to talk about this really quick. Let's go across the Narrow Sea over to Essos and where Dany is right now. And, you know, I thought it was really neat that she's walking in the Khalasar now, and she's basically a slave for a few minutes. And she's getting whipped, actually. And I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, how the mighty have fallen. You know, like, you're not arrogant anymore. You're not this haughty queen of Meereen. You're, like, you're being whipped, and they're talking all this shit walking beside you. And I even tweeted out, I was like, man, the Dothraki are so romantic because they're sitting there talking all this horrible shit about her right next to her, and she can understand everything they're saying. And then she gets in and she reveals who she is. And I've been saying this for a long time. It's like every season of Game of Thrones, we have to have the same speech from Daenerys. It's, I am Daenerys Stormborn, Targaryen, Unburned, Breaker of Chains, Mother of Dragons, blah, 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 blah. I will take mine by fire and blood, blah. We have to have that speech every season, it seems like. And she basically starts to rally that off again this season. And then he just laughs at her. And I was like, oh, my God. Thank you. Somebody finally laughed at her. I'm so happy.
It's because she doesn't get it. Like that's,
she doesn't
that's
get
her
it. Nobody
character.
Cares who she is.
That's her character at this point, is someone who doesn't get it. Like, she is great at riding in on a dragon and killing people and disrupting the flow of things, but she is an awful queen. Like, she is bad at it. She takes bad advice. She takes bad advice, and she takes a lot of liberties with the stuff that she's very, like, this will never happen while I'm here, and then she lets it happen anyway, and, like, oversees. Like, she doesn't understand why people would be upset with her because she doesn't get it. And then she's in a tent of a Dothraki cowl or whatever you say that word, and she's spitting off all this stuff like any of that means anything to him. The only thing that meant anything to him was when he found out that she – was married to Khal Drogo. So
yeah,
she doesn't get it.
So
he honestly, like, she just kept rattling off titles until she hit one that he respected. And the one he respected was widow of Khal Drogo. And suddenly Khal Drogo's name, like, gave her protection. But, you know, even though it gave her protection, it's, you know, so she's like, okay, awesome, this one will give me protection, so now you're going to let me go, and I'll give you some horses, and we'll all be great. And he's like, no, if you're the widow of a Khal, you go to where widows of the Khals go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just bought her time.
Florida.
Yeah,
oh, God, we're going to Dorne.
No, it really did feel like, you know, she just bought herself time, you know. I mean, at least she won't be, you know, her agency won't be taken away from her or anything like that or whatever. I mean,
bullshit are we referencing that I don't get?
Okay. No, it's a long story. We'll explain it to you off air.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anyway,
I'm sure
it's something.
Know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's something that happened last season. So we'll have to tell you later on. But I really feel like that she just bought herself some time. But I felt it was so funny that Sir Friendzone and, you know, Danny's current lover, if you will, are looking for Danny and you know. Man, they are some freaking awesome ass trekkers, aren't they?
Well, no, they explained that. I'm glad
I was
going to
say that too. They did a great job of highlighting why it was, because I was sitting there thinking, if there were 10,000 horses here, there should be hoof marks. Mm-hmm. And they all rode in a circle around her, and she dropped her ring in that like 6x6 circle. Much easier to find. Made a lot more sense. I think
but
that's
still,
probably
and then, I mean. Out of all the places,
and before
that,
they on the way there, they found the charred ram. So like they were finding clues on the way over there. Like they were following Drogon's trail of burnt, crisp bodies. So they knew they were going in the right direction. Which
it was
is
like
cool
a
to me. That
crumbs.
Means yeah, little breadcrumbs from Drogon, and that take heart, people. That means Drogon is on the move, looking for his mommy. So hopefully he goes and burns some dicks off in the Dothraki Khalasar pretty soon, but we'll see that hopefully in two or three episodes from now.
Weren't those wives a bunch of haters?
That's how every Dothraki horde is. All the wives are always haters.
They're a bunch of haters. I was just like, oh, they just haterating on Dany, and I was just like, damn.
Can I just say that the best possible outcome to the storyline for Dany is her going to this retirement village in wherever and becoming like the fourth Golden Girl and having like a thank you for being a friend like moment at the very far south point of the map in like the Game of Thrones intro is just like four gray haired, white haired ladies like sitting at a table playing canasta and making catty comments to each other. And that is the best way for her storyline to end, in my opinion. So just throwing that.
Yeah. No, oh my God. I just gonna agree. Now I want that. Now I can't think of anything else.
Yeah, now I
that.
Can't think of anything else. I want that course.
Before we leave Essos, let's go back to Meereen and Tyrion walking the streets with Varys. And the line of – probably the line of the night, in my opinion, is you walk like a rich person. That was great. There's always great lines from Varys. Anytime Varys is in a scene, he's always going to deliver the lines. And he delivered a line that actually fan side just turned into a T-shirt for Winter is Coming. It's called – and it's got the silhouette of Tyrion walking with his hands behind his back, and it says, you walk like a rich person. It's a great T-shirt, and it's going to go online pretty soon.
Can't
so.
You make a T-shirt of what Tyrion said back to him?
Yeah, that's the shirt I want.
Because you know you have no dick. Yeah, that was great. And then I also liked how Tyrion told that lady, here, for your baby to eat. He basically told a lady he wanted to eat her baby. That was awesome. But did you guys catch something? I watched it today twice just to see if I could catch anything I missed before last night. And my wife actually picked up on this. While they're walking, before they noticed that the fleet's on fire, and I know you want to talk about this, Corey, because that really bothered you. But
you're talking about the people that were looking at them?
Yes. The person behind the screen watching them. Do we think that this is the Sons of the Harpy, or is this somebody else? Who's watching Tyrion and Varys at this point?
You asking me?
Anybody? I mean, yeah. Like you want to talk about this? Let's talk about who's actually watching our favorite little guy Tyrion and his buddy Varys. Right. Like, what's going on?
I'll make an out of the box suggestion and say that it's one of Littlefinger's spies and somebody with ties to King's Landing that has found Tyrion and is trying to maybe plot a way to kidnap him or just kill him and take his head back to whoever. I don't know. Damn. That's my guess. There we go. So
I like the way you think. I like the cut of your jib, sir. I didn't catch that last night, and I didn't catch it on the second viewing today. It was the third viewing, and my wife was like, "You didn't see that?" And I was like, "No, I don't pay attention most of the time. I'm always got my head."
Thank God you're running this website and podcast.
I know, right? Anyway, so let me hear your thoughts again. We're gonna stay with Corey because Corey was really upset about the fleet being burned. Let me hear you talk about that.
We are never, ever, ever getting the hell out of that city. For the love of God, we spent two seasons trying to get this bitch some boats. And for some reason, they catch on fire in the first – that was their way. That was one of two moments in this season or so far in this episode, excuse me, where they just like – The two showrunners look at the camera and go, "Sorry, we can't leave just yet. I know you really want to, but the storyline prevents it." And so
they just gave a big middle finger to all the fans. Like,
where it was like, "I just can't wait for Dany to get back and get on her boat." And then, I mean, the moment after I said that to myself, it's like, "Oh, these boats are all on fire." What a dumb – we don't even know what happened, do we?
So they burned
200 boats just like that.
Yeah. In the books, it's a sieging army that burns the boats. It's another army that's
well. In the show, it's nothing. And
it's basically you're led to believe that it's the Sons of the Harpy that burn the boats. And but I'm here to tell you, my friend, do not despair for the ships because there's help coming. In the form of another seafaring family from Westeros, but we'll that's not for this show. That's for another time. Anyway, no, you're right. There was a little bit of despair at that moment. If you didn't know what was going on, you'd go, "Oh God, we're never leaving. We're never getting out of here." I like that. But there is some help coming, and we're not too far away from that. And we'll see it played out soon. Hopefully, in fact, I think in episode two, Annie, right? Are we going to see some great choice?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. It is suggested, and yeah. we have clues that could be, but it's not official.
Well, I know the synopsis for episode two and three came out, but I'm not sure if that family was mentioned specifically. But anyway, so we can leave Essos behind now. We've talked about Dany and her speeches and Tyrion and all that good stuff. Now let's go to everybody's favorite topic, and we're going to talk about Dorne.
Oh, here we thought we were talking about Arya. Who said my favorite topic?
I'm sorry. I know. We said we were leaving Essos, and I thought that we would come back later to talk to Arya and Braavos. Right, but we got to get Dorne out of the way at some point. And I wanted to talk really quickly about it. I just feel like at this point, David Benioff and Dan Weiss were like, "You know what? This has been an abortion, and we need to go ahead and stick a little vacuum cleaner in and suck it all out."
That was the second moment that I referenced earlier was when – when they just had knife, and then they just stood there. It was like, all right, it's like we're done. And the whole – the camera panned out and just – that's it.
Yep.
Are we done in Dorne, please?
Yep,
can we leave
we're done.
This place?
No, let's leave Dorne to the silly place.
Yeah.
That was amazing, man.
That was awesome. Great setup.
I just – what really bothered me about Dorne is it could have been so much better, and I feel like that was the weakest point of season five, obviously. You know, they won so many awards, and upon a second viewing of season five, it did not – I didn't hate season five as much as I did the first time I watched it. But Dorne was obviously the weakest point, and they had to cut it out like a cancer. And this is their quickest way of doing it. Let's get rid of it in episode one of season six. And not only let's get rid of it, let's get rid of it in like 10 seconds. Let's kill Dorne. Let's kill Hotai. Let's kill Trystane. Let's do it really quickly. And let's do it really stupid, too, because Doran's bodyguard turns his back on a sand snake. That's something that would never happen in the books. I almost want to geek out over that. And
Can I just say, as a show watcher, not to step on your toes, Razor, but as a show watcher only, I haven't read the books, I was promised that Dorn was interesting and cool and the people there were strange.
I don't know who lied to you in the books.
I did.
I'm sorry. I referred to the damn Dornishman and the idiot Ironborn, okay? I was not pleased with either storyline. We are actually going to deal with the Ironborn this year, and I really hope that they deal with it better. I feel like with Dorn, the show made the same mistakes that the book made. Oberyn was an amazing character, and he went over so well in book three that Martin decided that we should go to Dorne in book four. And no, we should not. It's boring. Doran sits there in his wheelchair in the water gardens, pondering for chapters and chapters and chapters. It is painful. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, the showrunners were like, we're not going to make the same mistake with Dorne. And then they went and made the same mistake with Dorne. Oberyn was so popular. I mean, Pedro Pascal was in, like, you know, the tiniest bit of season four, and he was the season four runaway hit. So they were like, no, we have to go to Dorne, and we'll do it differently. We'll send, you know, Jaime, and we'll send Bronn, and we'll make it interesting. Nope. It's still boring.
Well, the horrible handling of the sand snakes is what made Dorne so terrible. Like, Alexander Siddig is an amazing actor, and honestly, the actresses who play the sand snakes, they're really good, too. They've all had their own established acting careers, they've all done great things outside of Game of Thrones, but here they get into Game of Thrones and they all just shit the bed, and I don't blame them. I blame the writing, I blame the choreography of the fights, I blame whatever you want to
blame.
I've seen Jessica Henwick, who plays Lady Nim, Nymeria. She's in Star Wars The Force Awakens, will be in Star Wars Episode VIII as an X-Wing fighter. She did a great job in those films, and then the girl who plays Obara, she won an Oscar when she was younger. I mean, these actors, and then of course, like I said, you have Alexander Siddig, an amazing actor, Dr. Julian Bashir. Come on, what are we doing with this guy? We're just gonna let him sit there for a few scenes and kill him? This is ridiculous. And we didn't even get to the best part of Dorne. We didn't get to the fire and blood speech. And I know we didn't have Quentin and we didn't have Arianne. We cut a lot of characters out because we didn't have false Aegon. The false Targaryen. We didn't have any of that because I guess you didn't want to do it in the show. We didn't want to bring all that extra stuff on to the show. Blah blah blah. Whatever. But Dorne was handled badly. I'm not like you, Annie. I actually did enjoy the Dorne plotline. I enjoyed the Grand Master plan because I liked it to be linked up with Quentin and his travels through Essos.
Quentin is such a drip. Oh my god.
What happened
to Quentin is that he got roasted by a dragon.
No, I agree, but if you connect it with Dorne, it's a great story. To me, I liked it. I thought it was a good storyline. And I love the Ironborn. I'm a huge Ironborn fan. But I just think that the show took – and you're right. A lot of people do not like the Dorne plot lines in the books. And Martin himself – I don't know if Martin's actually come out and said that he kind of did filler with that book or not. I don't know if it was Martin that said it, but that's been a big complaint about those books, is that Dorne was almost like filler. I will begrudgingly admit that could probably be one of the weaker points of A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. But I will say this also, the show did way worse than the books ever had a chance to do with them. And once again, here we are in season six, a chance to rectify our mistakes with season five. And even if you wanted to kill off Dorne, you had a chance to do it better than you could have done a better job with it. And still, we had continuity problems. How the fuck did those two sand snakes show up on Tristane's boat?
On the boat with Marcella.
I did too. I was told that he wasn't. Somebody told me he wasn't. I thought he was on the boat with Marcella as well.
I didn't think he was. I thought that he was still in Dorne.
Dorne.
That he followed behind in another boat, basically.
Yes.
Well, see, and that doesn't make any sense. Why would you sit in the harbor of King's Landing when your girlfriend, a Lannister, or a Baratheon, but a Lannister, is dead, and and your family has an ancient feud with that family. So why would you sit there and chill and paint the eyeballs for the stones for her body? I would get the fuck out of there. I'd be like, no, I'm going home. I'm going home to daddy. But no, he stayed there with no guards, and then he makes the biggest mistake in the world. He turns his back on stupid Spice with the with the spear on Speary Spice, and it's like, I knew that was going to happen. Obviously, I saw the leaked photos before that happened, but I mean, even if I hadn't seen the leaked photos, I would have known that he was going to get stabbed through the back of the head. Wait, that was coming.
Time out. The girl Obra is the chick from Whale Rider.
Yes.
I didn't know that. Whale Rider is a good movie. So what the hell's happening here?
Mm-hmm. I told you, man. These it's not their fault. It's not the actor's fault.
Sorry.
Anyway, anybody else have anything they want to put in on Dorne? We can just go and leave this alone like the show has done. We can just leave it.
Put a nail in it. Let's put a thumbtack in it and just move on to maybe Braavos.
Well, yeah, let's go to Braavos and let's talk about Blind Arya. I didn't have any expectations when it came to this. I didn't think that Arya's storyline was going to be fleshed out until like midway in the season. So I thought it was kind of cool she got her ass kicked, and I read an interview on Arya today, on Macy Williams today, and she talks about she doesn't even think that it was the Waif being a dick. It was the Waif basically teaching her how to fight blind. So how did you guys, how did you interpret that season, that scene?
Okay, first of all, I'm all about Team Arya. And so when the Waif came in there, or as in the Winter is Coming article called her the busted Kimmy Gibbler, which I absolutely freaking loved, that article, if you get a chance, you need to read the recap of the of episode 601. It is absolutely hilarious because I read it today and it was perfect. And so yeah, the busted ass Kimmy Gibbler was fighting excuse me, Arya, and I just kept on going, oh my god, like, she's blind, what else do you think she's gonna do? She's not gonna be able to protect herself. So of course I was already hating on the Waif anyway, but I get what she's trying to do. She's trying to teach her how to fight blind and or just fight in general without one of her senses or whatever the case may be. I still didn't like seeing Arya getting her ass whooped with Sansa is still like walking around like, yes, you can be my, protector, blah, 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 and stuff like that. It really kind of pissed me off.
They're on opposite ends of the spectrum, though, at this point.
One Arya is, on one. But I did love the fact that, Sansa really does want to get her family back together. And, that was one of her concerns. Like, hey, do you know where my sister is? And poor freaking Arya sitting in Braavos just, begging for money. And
those are real contacts, by the way. Macy Williams did an interview before the season and talked about how painful those contacts were. Like, she did an Instagram photo, didn't she, Annie?
Filming? What she looked like basically with big ice packs under her eyes, because the contacts are basically, they cover the entire white of her eyes, so her entire eyeball is covered. And so fighting while wearing those was extraordinarily difficult, according to her. And apparently she smacked the girl who plays the Waif, Faye Marseille, apparently got smacked around and bruised pretty badly because, Maisie was actually fighting blind.
It's not really acting, though, is it? Like, it's more just fighting with contacts in and swinging a stick around.
The contacts are painted white, so she can't really see.
Yeah, no, I'm saying, like, at what point is it no longer acting, and is it just making a girl blind and giving her a stick?
Sadistic sons of bitches. All right, so hopefully we'll see some more from Arya. Looks like from the trailer we will see some more of Arya next episode.
And I just want to ask, are we going to see magical Jesus back again?
Sexy Jesus?
If you look at my breakdown of the trailer, yes, his arm actually shows up. You see him in the trailer. That's him grabbing the stick away from her.
Oh, Annie. Shit.
Yeah, Annie. If you go.
Tell him by who he was by his
arm. Go to my article. I have a screen cap of it, and it's definitely his outfit.
Annie's got some magical food. Hey, she knows how to find that shit.
If you're listening to this podcast, you can't get this kind of shit from any other website. Winter is Coming is going to give you the breakdown of a mofo's arm. Okay, I'm just telling
who is,
you.
Who is Sexy Jesus? I don't know who you mean by that.
Jack and Hagar.
Oh, okay, the guy that made her blind. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yes, yes, Sexy Jesus.
All right, respect.
So, respect, respect. So, let's leave Arya alone now. We've talked about everything else. Let's go back to the wall now. Let's finish this episode out strong. And let's try to hold our gag reflexes back a little bit, and let's talk about that big, huge reveal of Melisandre removing the necklace and showing that she's actually Miracle Max from The Princess Bride. That was just –
Don't rush the
so,
wet woman, Sonny. You get right miracles.
Have fun storming the castle.
That was – that's something that book readers knew was – knew. We kind of suspected all along she was that old. So it really wasn't a big surprise, but the thing that stood out to me was she's basically given up. She's basically just said, you know what, I don't have the faith that I used to have. Stannis is dead. I've made sacrifices in the name of the Red God, R'hllor, and none of it has worked out. And now Jon Snow is dead, and I saw him fighting. I saw him in the fires fighting as Winterfell burned, and I don't know what to do. You know, like none of it's working out anymore. And so I think her taking off the necklace, turning into the what, however old, 400, 200 year old hag she is, and then actually going to bed, which is something that Melisandre has been known in the books. She doesn't sleep and she doesn't eat. So for her to actually climb into bed and go sleep is like a symbolic gesture of her giving up. And something that has been brought to my attention by other commenters is this is exactly the point that Thoros of Myr got to as a Red Priest of R'hllor. Is he gave up on his faith as a Red Priest, and he was at his lowest point. And just as he gave up, that's when he brought back Beric Dondarrion from death. So I think maybe this might be a way to counterbalance Melisandre's powerful faith with her giving up, and hopefully maybe bringing in Jon Snow's resurrection that way. I don't know if he even will be resurrected. We don't know. But Isis, what was your thoughts on that big, huge twist or reveal, if you would have it?
Okay. It was as a non-book reader, or as Unsullied, if, like you like to call me, I was completely shocked about that reveal, because the entire time I had one of our other friends who's on this podcast sometime, Bandit, just needling me about, oh, Jon Snow's dead, Jon Snow's dead. And as soon as I saw her and, like, she started taking off her dress, I was like, oh, my God, this is the moment that she is going to fuck Jon Snow back to life. This is it. This is it. Are you watching this? Are you watching this right now? And then when she takes the necklace starts to glow red and stuff like that, and then she takes it off, and then I saw my 90-year-old great-grandmother naked. Literally, like, that's what it reminded me of. I was like, oh my God, what just happened? And so I don't know what kind of powers that necklace she had, what, like, kind of Instagram filter, you know, it's like fucking covered for everybody. Like, how do you not smell old skin? Like, I don't get it. So it was really, really kind of interesting.
Old skin has a smell?
It does. It really does.
Never had an elderly relative?
They smell. Old people smell. Anyway, like, they just.
I've euthanized some elderly relatives.
Like, I took care of my 90-year-old great-grandmother for a summer, and let me tell you, it changes you. So let me tell you, it was just one of those situations where I was like, oh, my God, this is absolutely ridiculous that she has given up. Like, the entire episode, I felt like Melisandre was just really downtrodden. She was really, really sad, down on herself. But this really brought it to a whole nother level that she kind of revealed her true self, you know.
This is a new side of Melisandre.
Yeah, she's not no, you know, pretty young thing that we all thought she was, and this is really who she is. And it was just so symbolic of how really.
I wish
she's gone.
I wish I could have saved my screen, my Google Chat screenshots from Friday, because Annie and I and Dan from Wicknet were all freaking out because those photos leaked, and we were all just like, "Oh my god, those can't be real! Oh god damn it, those can't be real!" And we were like,
graphic.
"No,
they were super graphic.
Somebody's photoshopped the ghost from room 237 in here, or this is Miracle Max's face on an old woman's body. Like, this isn't right. This is not. Somebody's trying to play a trick on fans of the show." And By Friday night or Saturday morning, Annie, we knew that they were real.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh god, oh my god, they really are going there. This is really going to happen. But Corey, what was your take on that reveal? How did you feel?
How did you feel, Corey?
How did you feel? Tell me about your feelings.
Okay.
In your nether regions.
Ooh.
In the pantaloons.
All right, keeps getting weirder. So, I guess first off, I thought that was probably my favorite scene of the whole episode because there was so much there that it was one of those moments that Game of Thrones does really well, where there are legitimately two different things you can interpret from that scene. There's A, that the necklace itself gives her power to appear young, and that her taking off that necklace for like the first time since early in the show, whenever she didn't look young again, which either could be a continuity error or tie into my second thing. But her revealing – or her just like taking that risk of revealing her true self, because a lot of her power comes from her appearance, and that's something that she knows. And that's how she got Stannis on board in the first place, was by being hot. And by getting into bed, by not having the – God, just not having the energy to appear young anymore and just be like, you know what, Puff, I'm old, I'm tired.
I can't even.
Yeah, exactly. And her getting into bed was very much, you know, like her giving up, like you said. But the problem with that is – I'm going to ramble here for a second. The problem with that is – it is very similar to the other guy, the drunk red guy that was bringing the other eye-patched red guy – I'm sorry, I don't know names – back from the dead a lot. Like, she had seen that happen and knew it was happening now. So if she knew that she could do that, if she believed in her God enough, why wasn't her first instinct to seeing Jon Snow that aha moment, like, I know this is when I can make my mark on this. I saw him fighting in the snow – at wherever. It's like, this is how it happens. I have to bring it back. Like, that's, to me, her not recognizing that is kind of, because she's very, like, smart. So, like, her not recognizing that was, to me, maybe she didn't trust her instincts anymore. Maybe she wasn't looking like that because she was so tired and beaten down. But the second thing is that the theory that I've read now, because you've seen the pictures of her character, like, taking a bath without the necklace on and still appearing young, whenever the person in the room was Stannis' wife. Right. Uh-huh. So I'm sure you all have read these series now, but other you might not have, that her power to appear young doesn't come from the necklace. She can appear however she wants to appear. The necklace maybe either makes it easier or keeps the spell going or whatever, or that her true believers, like Stannis' wife, see the old woman all the time. And
so it's like Photoshop.
It's like actually my girlfriend said it's like season one of American Horror Story with the maid, where the guy sees the hot maid and the wife sees the old maid, and it's like she chooses to reveal herself like that because that's how she gets the power over you. Her being hot and showing herself as hot to Stannis' wife, who already truly believed in the power of the Red Woman, gets her nothing. Stannis was never a true believer. He just was looking for an edge. And you know,
which is why he banged her on the table.
Exactly, right. So, like, that's – she had to keep that appearance up when he was there, but, you know, maybe we just weren't seeing – and I don't know if I necessarily believe that, but it's one of those moments in the show where legitimately I'm intrigued by where they're going and what's going to happen, because she really did look defeated there, something we haven't seen from her ever, even in the face of defeat until now and the last episode of last season. So,
yeah,
Annie, do we
– I agree with you. Like, she was confident. So she's been confident that she was on the right path throughout this whole entire, you know, show. And this is really the kind of first inkling that you get, like, oh my gosh, she is just broken down. And, you know, I mean, you know, of course I want her to go ahead and fuck John back to life and stuff like that. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know if she's got it in her. I don't know if she's got it in her, you know, magic vajayjay to bring him back to life, because she is so beaten down. But I feel like those guys are going to bring her back. I think the guys at Castle Black are going to be like, look, you need to snap out of it. I've seen what you've been able to do. You know, I need you young and beautiful again, and let's do this.
Well, maybe it's Davos' faith in her that'll bring her back. I don't know. Maybe Davos believed in her for once.
Well, and Davos hated her. Well, not, I don't want to say hated her, but he...
Oh, he hated her.
No, he hated
absolutely
her.
Hated.
Yeah.
He hated her.
Well, okay. He hated her, and for all the things that she has done and what she represents and stuff like that. So I feel like that if he, you know, kind of snaps her out, if he pulls a Jamie on her, you know, kind of tries to get her to snap out of it, that that maybe she'll really will come back into her own, or that may be her last little ba-bam, and then she'll die. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, we might see what happens next episode. We definitely know that the Night's Watch will continue to try to get in that room next episode, so I'm sure that we'll I'm not sure of anything. Hopefully we'll see something from Melisandre next episode. Annie, I want to ask you really quick before we drop a finale on this podcast, but let me ask you something. Do we know if that was Carice Van Houten in a, like a bodysuit? Because those eyes were really
I believe
they reminded
so.
Me of,
I believe
that was Carice's
eyes.
It,
I believe it is actually her underneath all of the makeup. Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
But
I didn't think it was another actress.
You know, and I just. You know, because Corey actually said this earlier, you know, we've gotten hints that the Red God is actually the one true religion and the actual religion that's right. To harp on needing to read Westeros history, but the Red God, if you actually go back and read about it and you study her religion, it's actually the religion that's based on what happened in the Long Night before, that
right.
Rhaelar is coming back and that the Great Other is going to bring the White Walkers over the wall. So theirs is actually the religion that has the right of it, which is why her losing faith now is such a powerful thing. You know, because this is, you know, she's always, as Isis says, she's always believed in herself. She's always had that front that, you know, whatever it is she's doing, she looks in the flames, she sees that, she interprets that, she is right, end of story. And it's never, she's never questioned herself. You know, she saw Shireen burn, therefore she should be burning Shireen. Now, clearly that's the next step. And it never occurred to her to ask, well, if that's the next step, what happens after that step? It's always been, well, that's the next step. Clearly that's what I'm supposed to do. So, you know, seeing her beaten down like this and seeing her, you know, show her true form. It also, you know, there was an interview with her today afterwards, and she said that being 400 years old actually kind of explains burning Shireen, because Shireen's what, 13?
Right.
What's 13 to a woman who's lived for 400 years?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, they're weighing the risk of killing one child compared to thousands and millions of other lives.
Yeah, it makes her very – it makes her see everything in a much more meta way than most people in the show. And
she told Stannis in season 3 – was it season 3 or season 2? She told Stannis, I've seen more than you've ever seen.
That was season 2.
I've been fighting a war longer than you have. So, yeah. That's – so –
well, you know, it's just interesting to me because that's a very much – like a very classic philosophy about like God's omnipotence, and is he allow bad things to happen, or do they happen and he can't stop them, or whatever else. And she got very, I guess, up her own ass more than else about like, oh, I've been around for 400 years. I know exactly how this is going down. You're the guy, Stannis, and blah, 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 blah. And you know, this is more than just her, you know, questioning her faith and questioning her abilities to see the future. I think it's maybe even her reckoning with the fact that she is not immortal, and she is not, which is another reason to take off the necklace. She's not immortal, and she's not you know, God. She is a messenger, and she maybe has forgotten that.
Yeah, and God has been showing her these things, and what did he lead her here for? She followed everything. She did everything he told her to do. She followed the flame. She saw all these things, and what are they, lies? What is the Red God been lying to her this whole time? You know, it's that's got to be a terrible feeling.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you. Or maybe her thought is, maybe I've been on the wrong side. You know, I've been thinking that I've been, communicating with the Red God, and I really wasn't. You know, maybe I was being
led. That's always a great point. That's
being led down a path, and it's really, in Christian terms, the devil has been leading me, and I thought it was really my God. So I really feel like that could be a situation, you know, as far as like us, you know, humans could relate that to, that internal struggle. What have I done? Was I being led down the right path, or have I been led astray? And then reconciling, hey, look at all the things that I did. Were they the right things? So anyway, it's just one of those situations, and I'm really interested. Yeah. They definitely made Melisandre not kind of like a you know, kind of a one pony kind of situation. They've given her some depth, I feel like, than before. Yeah. she was just the lady who had the ghost that come out of her coochie. I really feel like they really have given her some meatier kind of topics, and that whole, the whole body thing, the whole, I mean, I'm telling you, like, I took care of my 9-year-old grandmother for a summer, and I was just like, holy crap, that is accurate. So it was,
well, again, like the way that we're talking about this and the way that we're discussing like the theological aspect and how we've seen what her God can do, again, it just comes back to, that's why that scene is the best scene in this episode. It wasn't the fun action, and it wasn't, you know, the witty dialogue. It was actually, although don't get me wrong, seeing a woman naked, as we've talked about in this episode, is in the top five things. But but seriously,
until you said that,
I love you, Corey. I love you.
They really did. Which is a funny in-joke, but when it's all said and done, that scene is an example of why Game of Thrones has the following it has and is so great, is because there wasn't a word spoken. It was shocking without being too revealing, in a sense.
Gratuitous,
and,
Yeah.
It was shocking. It was very real. It was very human from someone that we haven't seen humanity from at all. So, again, adding, like you said, Isis, her not being a one-trick pony anymore, it's made her character that much more intriguing. It's made the show that much better. And it was far and away, for me, the scene of the episode.
Interesting thoughts. And those are all great thoughts. And that, with that being said, did anybody – I'm sure you all got a chance to watch the trailer for the next episode. So I'm going to ask you in turn, what stood out to you for episode 2 of season 6, Isis, Go?
Okay, so I was really excited about Bran, that, like, he – I think his testicles dropped now. And
we haven't seen him since season 4.
Exactly.
So.
And so he's a hell of a lot taller and stuff like that. And so I'm really interested to see where this is going to go with his storyline, because we have not seen him in so long. It's like – I'm glad they didn't do it in this episode, because I would have been annoyed with them bringing him in. But now that we've kind of, you know, wrapped, I don't want to say a bow around a couple of storylines, one of them being Dorne. Yes, we wrapped that shit in a bow and kicked it out the door. But I feel like we're ready now to go ahead and give his storyline some justice. So I'm really interested to see what's going to happen to him.
What about you, Corey? What stood out to you?
I don't know. I think finally getting to move Daenerys' story along, because she didn't used to be so damn boring. And finally getting to get her story to take a step in a direction that isn't her putting on a fancy blue dress and preaching. Like, I feel like that's something I'm excited to see again, is her having to fight to get to the top again, because that was when she's been at her best as a character. So
I agree 100%. The Meereenese knot from Dance with Dragons is the most boring part to me, that entire book. Annie, what stood out to you?
Well, when I was breaking down the trailer, there was a moment that I wished that I had the ability to GIF instead of just do a screenshot. And it's Ramsay, and he's standing in front of Roose Bolton, who is eating dinner, looking at him coldly, saying, "So Sansa and Theon escaped." And Ramsay is basically like, they went to the wall. We're pretty sure they went to the wall. You know, the south gate's not, we could take an army. And he's like shifting his weight back and forth from foot to foot. And he looks so nervous. And it's such a terrible idea that he's spewing, you know, to take an army to march on Castle Black is a bad idea in the summer months when there's no snow on the ground. And now he's basically saying, let's pack up the entirety of Winterfell's army and go march on the wall. I mean, it's
especially if you're trying to win the North.
I mean, that is such a desperation, stupid Donald Trump like idea. You know, it's just like, and you can just see Roose Bolton like, Trump. What even?
I will say that wall is huge. It's a huge wall. It's a great wall. It's a great wall.
I don't even care.
So, yeah, anyway, I just, like, that's actually seeing Ramsay not being in control and seeing him get kind of desperate, that's what I'm looking forward to.
I'm with Isis. I'm really looking forward to seeing Bran, and hopefully we'll see some great flashbacks Hodor. In this episode. Hodor. What I want to see is the resolution of the Night's Watch and the men behind the door. I want to know if Ed will be able to bring the wildlings back, and I have a bit of an idea of what will happen. I just I'm hoping that I'm right about this, and if so, it's going to be a badass episode. But involving
episode 1-1.
Episode 2 involving 1-1.
Oh, 1-1 forever.
1-1 forever.
Am I going to have to videotape myself watching this episode?
Oh, no, you'll just be really excited typing in all caps when it happens.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. We'll see.
But hopefully, I don't know if that's going to happen. I just know that if Ed returns to the Wildlings, it might happen. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see what happens with that story, if they're going to continue that along or if they're going to make it eke out into, like, episode 3 or 4 or 5. We don't know. But hopefully they'll resolve it quickly.
They're going to eke. You better believe that.
But that's going to be it for tonight. We've run the podcast a little long, about an hour and 20 minutes tonight, but it's the first episode of the season, and that's kind of normal. You just wait till our finale.
Hashtag
oh my
Coochie
God.
Ghost. Winter's coming.
Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next
Are
week.
Are you afraid? You should be.
I thought he was the man to lead us through the long night.
A face will be added to the whole.
You would spill blood in this holy place.
The gods won't mind.
Show them what Lannisters are.
And make no mistake, the dead are coming.
Dragons do not do well in captivity.
How do you know this?
That's what I do. I drink, and I know things.
They have no idea what's going to happen.